Good morning, everyone. Can I ask you to please take your seats so that we may start? Well, I don't think it really matters. I mean, we have a lot of room because this is a larger conference room than we really needed. But we really chose this room simply because we thought, because we were going to use a lot of visuals, that it would give you an opportunity to see more clearly. So don't worry about spaces because, you know, we know that people may come in, may come late. Just if you need to sit further front, you can because there are many seats in the front. Before we start, as usual, I would like to make sure that you take off your cell phones because you know those are nuisances during our communications workshops in particular. So I would ask you to just take the time and make sure that your cell phones are either put on silent, or if you would like to take them off completely, that would even be better. It's my pleasure to welcome you to our communications workshop, which is entitled Social Storytelling in the Age of Data, Meaning, and Momentum. And we've added a little caveat, particularly for you, because you are the audience. How do NGOs leverage social media to reach broad audiences? We've been talking about social media for some time. We've been involved with social media now for almost a year. And we thought that this would be a great nexus to come together for this year's communications workshop. I am Gail Binley-Taylor. I'm the information officer in the NGO relations section. And I would first of all like to extend our thanks to the Communications Committee of the NGO DPI Executive Committee for collaborating with DPI NGO Relations to hold this communications workshop. There are two members here, and I'd just like to make sure that we acknowledge them, and I'd ask June and to stand, you know, and Catherine, please, so that we can acknowledge you. I'd also like to thank Wendy Levy, who is a magic maker. She just makes things happen. And this is Wendy. Wendy has been with us before, for those of you who don't remember her, but she's been with us before. And she's brought a team of collaborators, and we thank them for making the trip from California to be part of today's events. I'd like to encourage our audience to live tweet during our communications workshop, because of course we want to get the message out that this is happening. And you can use the hashtag at DPINGO, which can be found in the middle of your screen. Well, no, you can't see it today, but it is. Hashtag DPINGO, one word. Today we've reached an important milestone in building communication skills within the NGO community. Yesterday we also made an important milestone. We reached just over the 1,000th tweet on our Twitter. So we are very excited. We've used traditional media, that is newsletters, magazines, newspapers, radio, to get the word out on what NGOs in association with DPI are doing to spread the UN word within their respective communities. We've also more recently, as I've just mentioned, moved to designing websites and using new media such as Facebook and Twitter to communicate our messages even faster and more informally to a wider global audience. But how do we know that we're being heard? And how do we know the extent to which we're influencing others with our messages? Today's briefing and afternoon workshop are going to take a look at new tools for telling our stories and getting our message to the widest possible audience, wherever they may be. We're posing the question, how do NGOs leverage social media to reach broad audiences? And more importantly, how do we measure the impact that NGO messages have on the audiences that they reach? These are questions we hope you will keep at the forefront of your mind throughout the day as we explore today's theme of how to get your message across through stories using new technology to reach the broadest possible audience. Stories are data. Our future capacity to act on this data, which is at our fingertips, will depend on our ability to combine the products we are creating with compelling and coherent narratives. Today's communication workshop will focus on how you, as NGOs, can use storytelling to track and share the data you collect and create to achieve sustainable impact and build stronger communities. During this morning's session, which has a slightly different format from our usual Thursday briefing, you will hear extraordinary stories from artists who have created dynamic, story-centered partnerships with NGOs to achieve impact on issues they care about. You'll also learn about case studies from the field and get a glimpse of what is achievable within your own organizations using new models of collaboration, technology, and strategy. Whether your NGO is involved with human rights, economic development, environmental justice, or any specialized field, today's communications workshop will provide you with new approaches for engaging communities and creating a measurable impact both online and on the ground. I'd now like to extend a very warm welcome to Wendy and her team. Wendy will be co-moderating for the remainder of this briefing. And as I said, she's no stranger to DPI as she's been with us before. She's the director of New Arts Access and is a senior consultant with the Sundance Institute Documentary Film Program and the co-founder of Sparkwise, an online data and story platform. Thank you for being with us. You have the floor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Gail. And yes, we are going to shake things up today because I like to present standing up because I'm passionate about this space and what we're doing here. I want to say thank you to Gail and to Catherine and Ashley and everyone here. It is an honor and a privilege to be standing before you to talk about this. And I luckily had a little bit of time to test run what I'm about to tell you at the Skoll World Forum last week, where I was addressing a room full of about, maybe there were 100 social entrepreneurs and leaders of nonprofit organizations worldwide. And the thing that they all had in common, whether they were dealing with human rights or environmental justice or racial bias or housing or fracking or whatever they were doing in their lives on the ground, everyone was together in the acknowledgement that if you want to change culture, if you want to change the world, you've got to change the stories. Now, we all know that social media has really impacted our ability to tell stories. Filmmakers, I have a master's degree in film. I started out as a filmmaker. And then the day I graduated from film school, they released the first version of Final Cut Pro, and all of a sudden, my storytelling toolkit changed. And I knew if I didn't keep up, my stories would be irrelevant. And it was so important to me to start spreading that word that I began working in innovation. And what I've learned recently, a couple of years ago when we were here, social media was everything. And you realize you could maybe struggle to get 100 people to come to a theater to see your movie. But if you did it right and strategically, you could send out, I don't know if this is still working, you could send out one tweet, and it could hit 100,000. Is it okay? Okay. It could hit 100,000 people, and they would do something, and all of a sudden, the needle was moving faster on the issues that we all cared about. And for me, that was the most important thing. I mean, yes, you want to tell a really good story. That's the bottom line. It's all about story. But if you don't make those connections and architect those pathways, it's not enough just to amplify a message, but you have to help if you expose, say you think you're exposing an injustice as a storyteller. What if you took it one more step and started to architect pathways to justice? And all of us work in the field of trying to make the world better, to heal the world of its wrongs, to give people voice. Stories do that. But this new era, the age of data, is about combining stories, emotionally driven stories, with the data that we collect and create that's all around us to actually seed movements for change. And so if I could ask you guys to just anything in your head that says, when you hear some of the stuff that we're going to tell you today, that says, oh, we can't do that in my organization. That's a tape that we all have. Change is hard. Capacity sometimes is not there. But we're hoping to give you some things that you can actually do and work within your groups to bring storytelling and some new technologies that are free and available on the web. What needs to happen is that stuff, that good, juicy storytelling stuff, and the data that's out there that you create and collect needs to come more into the DNA of your operations. Because it's not just what you do and then the stories you tell about them. It's really so much more about the integration of the story of your organization, the core of what you do, the people that you work with, and connecting that to the data that you create, the impact that your organizations are having on the ground and in the world. So just this quote is really interesting because the notion is, if you want to mobilize people to do anything, in this case to protect the environment, apocalyptic messaging doesn't necessarily work. We have to organize campaigns that tap into people's sense of pride in their heritage. It's about connecting with people on a cultural level and on an emotional level, and then letting them tell the story with you. We talk about now designing with and not for. The people that you work with on the ground that come to your organizations, that pass through your organizations for services and support, they are storytellers too. And we actually, in our business, we talk about them as the people formerly known as the audience. And as soon as you realize you're not just pushing stories out into the world, like it's great, 1,000 tweets, that's great. Tweets are micro stories, right? But what's really important is how those stories come back into the world. And what happens after you tweet 1,000 times? What did the people who read those tweets and retweeted them, what did they do? So during this briefing, we're going to give you some examples of some projects that have happened. And I want to tell you the core thing that they all have in common, whether they're forced evictions or ending racial bias or all the other stuff I'm going to tell you about, the thing that they have in common that I think unifies all of this is that we're all trying to see significant change in the world. And we all create data. And we all have stories. And how we choose to leverage them to push the needle on those important issues, that's where your strategy comes in. And that's where this whole notion of storytelling and data come together. This is a project that I wanted to tell you about that I'm working on very closely now. I just got back from India. I work with an NGO on the ground there called Priyasam, and a man named Amlan Ganguly, who's won many awards, he works with young people in the slums of Calcutta who are not even on the map. They live day to day. They have no potable drinking water in their slum. You have to walk 15 miles to get any. And he is taking these kids, building after school programs that have them going door to door, lowering polio rates in their slum. They used to do it on yellow legal pads, actually marking off on maps that they drew where babies were born that hadn't been immunized. They brought them back to the NGO and he entered them into the system, eventually got someone out to immunize those babies. So they came to a program that I was running and we brought together technology. This is the new table that you guys are sitting at. You, your expertise as NGO leaders in your field, then you bring a storyteller and you bring a technologist, and there is nothing you can't do. Nothing. And we have here in the briefing today Eric Doversberger from Google, who has been my Google guy for about the last 5 years. I can't do anything without him. Google has a wonderful program that they give 20% of, Googlers can give 20% of their time to nonprofit projects. You too can have a technologist from Google or anyone else to help you say, yes, we can do this. Because the question is, what if we could do this? What if we could end hunger? What if we could reduce polio rates? And that's the question that this project asked. The kids were saying, what if we could lower polio rates in our slum? When Eric got there to work with these kids, we looked on Google Earth, they weren't there. So Eric put them there. And now they go door to door, and today, two of the kids from the slum in Calcutta, where we work with, two of those young people, age 10 and 14, are speaking in Seattle before Bill Gates. Like, not in front of Bill Gates, but Bill Gates is giving a presentation and these kids are going first. because they have become change makers, leveraging their story and leveraging new technology, because now they go door to door with a mobile device. And they do a survey, and that survey data goes directly to the health department. They've lowered the polio rates by 70% in their slum. This is the power of the story and the technology coming together and the vision. Without the NGO, it doesn't happen. But without the new technology, it happens much slower. And it takes these new forms of collaboration to really make it happen. This is some screenshots from a website of an organization called Goodweave. And they work around the world to end child trafficking. What they do is really they sell rugs. They sell rugs with the Goodweave label that guarantees that no child trafficking has gone into that rug. No underage girl has been forced to sit at a loom hour after hour, day after day. That's what they do. But on their website, before you get to the rugs, before you get to the business that they're in of selling good rugs, you get stories. You see the people that they're working with. You hear their stories. You hear their arc of where they were, and then they got touched by Goodweave, and now they have an education, and now they are helping to end child slavery. And then you sell the rugs. And Goodweave realized that the power of the story of the people, enabling the voices of the people they worked with and leveraging social media to get that word out, so they have a connected website that has a blog, yes, they tweet, and yes, they Facebook, but it's together realizing that in the DNA of their operations of selling rugs, they have incorporated really, really good storytelling. And so there's a couple I'm going to go through before the other folks present. I want to go through kind of quickly some slides of new projects and websites that have prioritized storytelling on the way to social change. Now, many of these websites, if you guys don't know WordPress, WordPress is your friend. WordPress is a free blogging platform, and their websites look like websites that a few years ago might have cost you $75,000 to make. And you can bring the stories of your people, the people formerly known as the audience who are now your collaborators, the people you serve. They're not the other. They are your arsenal. They go into the world to tell your story better for you than you could tell yourself. This is a new website called Dadaab Stories that reveals life in one of the world's largest refugee camps. And so they created, look at the use of photography. Imagine if your NGO had a resident photographer that could use the photograph. And these photographs, not only are they the basis of a great story, they are cultural data. Stories are data too. So yes, 1,000 tweets, very important number. But how you then track really how your community is doing, are they moving out of poverty, whatever it is that your field is? The stories and the data together tell that really effectively. So you want to think visually. Here's a project called 30 Days of Ramadan. So if we want to start ending the bias against Muslims in this country in particular, let's let the Muslim people tell the real story of Ramadan. In an environment like this, there's 30 days and 3,000 stories. If you create a two-way conversation on your website where the people you work with and the people you want to impact also have a voice, your impact goes up, because then you can start tracking how many people are on the site, how many stories are being shared. You can engage them to do things. Every one of the stories on this site is shareable. You look at your websites now. Is there any content on there that someone could grab and share easily on Facebook, on Twitter, on Tumblr, on Pinterest? These social media platforms, thousands and thousands of people are there, and your stories, they need to be there too. So you don't need a feature film. Sometimes it's just a short video. Sometimes, in this case, this is a group called See Potential that works in blighted neighborhoods in Chicago. This, they disrupted the status quo by putting large-scale photographs on burned-out buildings and let the community be part of the renewal. So the digital platform that we're going to create for this project could be people putting together a virtual new community as the actual community is being built. Think about ways you can really engage your audiences, your community, in a co-created story environment. You want to bring collaboration into the mix so you don't have to just push these stories out and push out the data, but you're actually creating the data with your community. And yes, online is a definite way you want to do it, but some of you work in countries where the internet sucks, frankly, right? It's really hard to tell stories on your mobile phone because people only have texting. So create a text-based tool where someone could text in, text to 41411, tell us your story. We'll give you information. There's lots of different ways to use technology in the ways that your people can use it. Sandy Storyline, I just wanted to show you this project because it's installed at the Tribeca Film Festival, which is happening right now, and you can see a real live installation of this website, which was put up when Sandy hit. This wasn't just a website to say, yes, there are people in crisis and we're here to help them. This is a way that the stories are used to heal because people can submit and they can also connect to services they need. So the stories and the data and the healing are all part of the same instinct, the same communication arc. And that's something that you as NGOs can really be at the center of. If you take your story, you claim it, but you also say to the technologists and the filmmakers in your region, let's work together on this. That's the new collaboration in this age that must happen in order for us to have effective storytelling. And in order for, if you really want to have an impact on the issues in which you're working, an organization that just does and doesn't effectively tell its story is really left out of the game because you can't reach those audiences. So it's worth taking a step back and building some capacity. And whether it's, this is an interactive education site that TED put up. If you're doing learning modules for students that, so you're helping spread the word via education. The new push in this age of data is to really think about kids as creators as well. So it's not just a couple of photographs or a film and some questions anymore. Now you get to work with artists to say, what's your story? Back to those students. And you give them, you spark them a story for a story. You give a story back into any community in which you're serving. And all of a sudden, you have a two-way communications model that you don't have to do as much work. Your community will do it for you. So I want to wrap up by showing you one tool that I created last year with the team at Tomorrow Partners in California that was answered the problem space of how do I know the impact that I'm actually making? I'm going to spend time telling stories, but I don't know the impact that they're really having. Now you can. Sparkwise, and we'll be going through Sparkwise this afternoon in a more hands-on way. But you can drag and drop the data that you create from Facebook, from Twitter, from Google Analytics, from an Excel spreadsheet. Anything that matters to you when you have to report to your funders, they want to know, you know, how many people did you serve? What did they, you know, did your reading scores go up? Did more people get good housing? Did you take, how many girls did you keep from being trafficked? Those numbers that matter more when they're in the context of your story. So now you have a dashboard tool where you can drag and drop video, audio, text, and hard data from the web and from your own spreadsheets and create dashboards that you can show to funders, that you can embed in news articles. And the cool thing about this tool, and this is something that whether you use Sparkwise or anything else, every story that you tell on the web needs to be shareable and lead somebody to do something that makes a difference in your organization and your movement. So with Sparkwise, you see these little action links at the bottom of these widgets, join the conversation, follow us. Those are customizable. So you embed a video about your organization, then you say, donate money to our cause, and they can click and immediately be connected. It's up to you, as the NGO leaders in this world, to create those connections for your people. If you don't, you're leaving a lot of really incredible human resources and value on the table. So this is the overarching data story question that we're going to be exploring today. And now I'm turning over to Chris Johnson is next. Do I stop for questions now? If anybody wants, before we move on, I've given a lot of information right now of the data story impact equation. If there's anything, if there's some burning questions now, we really want to make this interactive. So it's really okay. Please speak into the mic. You know, you have to speak, touch the middle bar to speak.
Where is SparkWise?
SparkWise is online at, the URL is SparkWise, SparkWise.se. It's a free tool. You can sign up right now while you're sitting there, and I will help you develop those dashboards with Eric this afternoon. Sure, SparkWise, SparkWise.se, SparkWise. And we made it for global NGOs to help you amplify the impact you're having on the ground. That's what this tool is for. And Eric from Google helped us build it, and it's fantastic. And it's fantastic because there's a global group of NGOs currently using it. And we launched it at SCOLE last year. It's great because you guys will use it. You bring the data and you give the meaning. This is that whole notion of meaning and momentum. You create meaning and stories around your data. There is no stopping your organization from being more effective and more impactful in your communities. Okay, so let me introduce Chris Johnson from a fantastic project called Question Bridge. The impact that Chris has been able to have on the ground with the NGOs that he's been working with is phenomenal. And remember, as you hear his story, his people are your people. Do that thing that really smart people are good at doing, which is translating automatically in their head. He did this. What if we could do this? I think you'll get a lot out of it. Chris, you're on.
Thank you, Wendy. And I want to say it's really an honor to be here because there aren't enough opportunities for artists who usually are thought of as being entertainers in some way, decorating the world, to be here to present with leaders of NGOs who really are on the ground actually doing things. But artists, of course, are people who translate their experiences into opportunities for communication. And this project called Question Bridge emerged from an experience that I had when I was 15 years old and witnessed the black community divide itself into those who could live away from the black community and those who chose to stay for very many reasons. This happened as an unintended consequence of the civil rights revolution. And so I saw this split where a community that nominally belongs to itself got divided. So the question was, how do you create some sort of form of communication between people who really need each other, but really are have barriers between their communications? And so I have a slide that illustrates the experience that I had in Houston, where Question Bridge was installed at a really amazing project called Project Row House. And I'm going to use this as a way to sort of demonstrate the kinds of issues that Question Bridge tries to engage with and two really key problems that the methodology that Question Bridge uses tries to deal with. So the experience I had was I went for a run early in the morning and I came across a group of black men who were standing around just talking to each other. And I had this instinctive response, which I think all of us understand, which is grounded in racial prejudice. And even me, who grew up in Bed-Stuy, had the experience of running along, and I felt myself veering away from these men. And then I questioned that experience, and I thought to myself, now why, what is it that's happening? What instinct am I responding to? So if I put this slide up and ask you to think, what would you do if you saw yourself amidst a group like this, what would your instinctive response be? And of course, as I said, there are two problems that are illustrated here. One is the resistance we have for accepting them as being normal human beings. And the other is that there are barriers between these men themselves, because we understand that black-on-black violence is usually the result of misunderstandings and projections and problems that exist within the black community. So, Question Bridge, to illustrate the methodology, what I want you to do is imagine if I could wave a wand and make you invisible. and not just invisible, but totally undetectable. And to make this work in this example, you'd have to be, let's say, 4 inches tall also. So imagine that you now are undetectable and you're standing on the table as a kind of privileged witness to what these men are actually saying to each other, to what their lived experience actually is. So what would you experience? Well, you discover that they're talking about the latest baseball game, that they're sharing stories about their families. What you would do is you would all of a sudden be connected with their humanity, because your invisible presence would give you insight into who they are as real human beings. So that's a demonstration of the question-based methodology, which tries to allow people who have barriers against each other to use the form of asking a question as a way to solicit information. Because one of the things that keeps us from listening to each other is that we're really not prepared to listen. Whereas if I ask you a sincere question, then I'm setting myself up to listen to your response. So what I want to do is show you the trailer from the project to give you a sense of the way it worked. When myself and three other collaborators spent 4 years traveling around the country soliciting these questions from African American men, all walks of life, all age, sexual orientations, and all we did was say, what I want you to do is use this project as a way to ask a question that you've always wanted to ask another African American man. Use the camera as a vehicle for that question, and then we will take that question. So what the project does is we will take that question to someone who could answer that question and give them a chance to answer. So here's the way it looks when we did this with totally strange men. What I mean to say is men who were total strangers to each other.
Black man.
Do you want to get out of the situation that you're in?
What is the reluctance for taking responsibility for improving our communities?
Are your children better or worse off as a result of your involvement?
Why wouldn't you be happy with your son being gay?
Why are you so violent?
Why do you have that take mentality?
Why are you afraid of being intelligent?
Why?
What I want to know is why.
I believe that we've incorporated a lot of things that are unhealthy to us.
We are supposed to be tough.
I can't let them see no type of sucker.
Along with various other stereotypes.
The level of mentorship in our community is not as strong as it possibly could be.
When I came up, crack was a quick way for a black man to make $1 million.
Sometimes I think because we think we're black, we're some other kind of human beings, but we're just like most other human beings.
Why didn't y'all leave us the blueprint?
We did leave you a blueprint.
We just didn't tell you where it was.
That's something that we dropped the ball on.
What do you fear?
That something will harm my children.
I fear success.
Am I the only one who has problem eating chicken, watermelon, and bananas in front of white people?
Hold on, bro. Y'all niggas crazy.
That word, we have to stop using it.
I think black people can say nigga anytime they want.
How dare you? What right do you have to use this word?
A lot of nigga questions for the rapper.
What is common to all of us that we can say makes us who we are?
This is the easiest question in the world to answer.
The thing that we have in common is that we are male and we are black.
All right, my question is, I try to live good, but I'm surrounded by bad. And I want to know what it is I could do to do better and live peaceful, surrounded by all evil. How can I do that?
So you can see how deceptively simple this methodology is. All we did was simply give that young man a chance to simply ask a question that had always been at the heart of his life. And then we took that question in video form and showed it to other men and got an incredible array of answers that comprises the content of Question Bridge, which began as an installation because we thought of ourselves as being artists, and so we thought that the museum was a perfect setting for it to be, but it turned out to have such meaning that it really needed to project into other places. And here I want to thank Wendy for being a bridge of a kind to realize that Question Bridge is actually a transmedia project that needed to exist in other forms. And so it became a website, which is going to become the repository of all the questions and answers. So people who ask a question would get a chance to see all of the array of answers that are attached to that question. People in the community will get a chance to upload questions that the community itself can answer. So it becomes a form of mediated dialogue that allows for an exchange of information from people who really need each other. It also became a curriculum because we realized that the people who really need exposure to the questions and answers that are coming from the African American community, in this case black males, are children. And so the curriculum gives a way for educators to download modules that we created that embody segments of the project into themes that become talking points for conversations. There are lesson plans, and we're able to offer it free as a download from the website. And we also organize community events because you saw an excerpt from one of the questions that turned out to be really key, where this young man from the hip-hop generation speaking to the civil rights generation is asking this really poignant question: why didn't you leave us a blueprint? Why aren't there specific guidelines that you could offer our generation for how to live? And so what we've done is create community events that we're calling blueprint roundtables, which are happening in all parts of the country. I just came from one at Wesleyan University last weekend, where African-American men, in this case, get a chance to speak elders to youth and back and forth using questions and answers in public as a way to sort of draw the wisdom that's inherent to the black community to the surface where it's available for all of us. And we also want eventually for this to become a documentary. So I want to show you some clips. But first, there are other parts of the team, so I have to let you know that Hank Willis Thomas was a student of mine, and he discovered the original project that I did in 1996, which used the black community as a whole as its source, and said that this might work again if we focus on black males. This is an example of Hank's work. One of the other collaborators is another ex-student of mine, Baite Ross Smith, who does work with what we call code switching, how identities shift depending on your context. And Kamal Sinclair, she's a playwright and a dancer and our sort of business center, but she's the one who actually created the curriculum. So those are our collaborators. And this is the person who inspired my shift from fine art photography, which I still do, but to video. Her name is Suzanne Lacey, a pretty well-known performance artist. And she and I did a project called The Roof is on Fire in the early 90s, which was really about listening. What we did was put kids in cars and give them a chance just to talk to each other as if they were in a private space. They had badges around their necks that said, shut up and listen. And an audience from the hills of Oakland got a chance to sort of eavesdrop. Well, that was a form of sort of reifying listening, and it gave me an opportunity a couple of years later to do this project on the black community. So this is a brief excerpt from Question Bridge, Black Community.
Have you given any thought to where the money comes from for people who are receiving public assistance? And do you care?
I've thought about where public assistance money come from, and I do care, but for one, I am on public assistance, and it's not because we don't want to work, it's not because we want to sit at home and get a check or anything like that. A lot of people perceive us young teenage mothers to sit at home and just collect a check, where a lot of times we do go out and look for work. We do work. We can't work as long because child care is really up there. At this point in time, I pay $300 a month for one child, and I have two. And I pay $150 a month for another child. The $300 is because my child is under two. The $150 is because my child is over two and is school age. So, yes, I know where the money comes from. It comes from taxpayers. But we do have people who take up American jobs who are not taxpayers because they're not an American citizen. How about that? We get decreases in our checks because we are American citizens, but yet if you're a refugee or you're an immigrant or you're an able working alien, legal working alien in the United States, you get an increase in your check when you come over here from different countries because the United States government have so-called some kind of agreement with them. They come over here and they're able to get grants to start businesses where we are already living here, working, doing the backbone of the country, and we don't get that same type of respect. But yet, people look down upon us because we are on public assistance. They like to say, oh, the black teenage moms are going out, opening their legs and having babies just to get on welfare to get out the house. That is not always the case. It's a small proportion that does that, but you only focus on this small proportion.
This is an example of the way that this real content that exists in the community, this project was a way to bring that content to the surface. And like I said, in this case, we used the same methodology of questions and answers with black men. But the important thing about question bridge colon black males is the colon, because it's really a methodology that could apply pretty much anywhere. And so we were invited, as I said, by an organization called Project Row House in Houston, which is really devoted to community development in the Third Ward of the Houston area, to really locate Question Bridge there as a way to bring the community together, to bring this content and wisdom, which is in the black community, but often is kept apart from each other. We set up the installation in one of their row houses and also the education model and functioned there as a sort of base for a rich inter-community conversation that wouldn't have already otherwise happened. So that's just a case study of the way Question Bridge can function. As I said, we're doing blueprint roundtables in communities all over the country as a way to sort of provide organizations there with vehicles for sharing content. So that's sort of a demonstration of the way an art project can evolve into a tool for enriching a community. And we would love to see Question Bridge picked up as a model for wherever there are divisions between people who nominally belong to each other but really are fractured by conflicts that really could easily be bridged if you simply use questions and open and safe places to answer as the vehicle.
Great. Chris, thank you so much. I wanted to mention to folks that may not be aware that when Question Bridge was first released, both the Brooklyn Museum and the Oakland Museum premiered an exhibition of the project simultaneously. I think to this day is maybe one of the most highly attended exhibitions at the Brooklyn Museum ever. So the idea that your NGO could be affiliated with a story project that puts you deep into the conversation that is current and relevant, and really where you start to see the end game of how do we end racial bias, these stories are steps towards that goal. And when the artists and the NGOs and the technologists affiliate together, that's the kind of thing that can happen. And you need to think at scale. And that's something that Chris did with Question Bridge. And if you think we could have Question Bridge and anything could be after that, the notion is that you're establishing, again, that story to drive the movement, to engage the people, and to get folks talking, because that's what can have the impact. But so it doesn't need to stay right within the individual NGO. Networking those stories, as you see that Question Bridge did, is how you then scale the impact around it as well.
Good. Are there any questions I can answer briefly? Yes.
Question Bridge black males, were the people who answered, were they ever identified somewhere?
Well, the process is really very interesting because the question, as you can imagine, sort of predicts where we need to go for an answer. Like maybe you saw some of the men there who were wearing prison garb, because as you can imagine, in the black community, a lot of questions relate to issues that got men incarcerated. So the people who answered those questions were the ones who really sort of embodied the wisdom behind it. And the list of who all the questions and answerers were presented at the installations, yes. But the most important thing is that the answerer represented an opportunity for them to speak to this question that had been at the center of their lives.
Just showed us something that we'd like to send people to.
Yes.
But for the responders who were from the civil rights, I couldn't name everybody, so I'm trying to find out from you, if I send someone to that website, will it identify those gentlemen who answered that question?
Well, all of the names of the participants will be on the website. Yes, that's true. They will be there.
I'm sorry to go back. The name will be there with the picture as they are talking?
Yeah.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you for this presentation. It's absolutely wonderful. And Wendy, before. While I'm watching all this, I'm thinking, I don't know if you spoke with Harry Belafonte, but in 2007, I had a meeting with Harry. Apparently, he was retiring, and he felt that he couldn't retire because there are so many gangs in the United States that need the older people to guide them to try and do something about it. And he went out to L.A. to deal with gangs, to talk to them. Couldn't get anybody from the civil rights group, his colleagues, to go with him. And he went to speak with them with the help of Susan Rice's cousin. Maybe you know something about this. He dealt with the Bloods, the Crips, he dealt with the Asian gangs, the Indian gangs, the whomever out there. And something very profound that in your statement here, where people don't listen, but they don't know each other, even though they may be standing on the corner. I looked at the body language of the first group where you were sitting there, and you see the head going this way and that way, but people are not really, they may be talking, but they're not really relating to each other. How can you use a program like this to intervene within gang culture?
Well, that's a beautiful question. Of course, as you can imagine, the divisions in the black community, of which gang culture is one of the great symptoms, unfortunately, is exactly what this methodology is designed for. Because what it does is it gives the people who have these burning questions, like that last question that the young man asked, how do I make a peaceful life when I'm surrounded by evil? That's a question that's in the heart of every young black person. And so what this did was create a safe place for him to simply frame that question and then bring it out into the world where people like Andrew Young, you saw Ambassador Andrew Young was one of the people there, or other anonymous young men who otherwise wouldn't have any way to communicate with him to provide an answer. So what Question Bridge does is simply create a safe place for both those questions and answers to come together so that men who are incarcerated, for example, could speak to young men who are in the street. So the editing is what creates this faux conversation, but the wisdom that's embodied by both the questions and the answers are already in the community. And so this is exactly the kind of thing that echoes what Harry Belafonte was attempting to do. But the reason Question Bridge exists the way that it does is that sometimes the presence of a person in the room creates resistances. And so we use video as a way to create a safer environment for those questions and the answers to come to the surface. And then we edit them together into a conversation that gets shared with the world. Yes.
Thank you so much for the presentation. I think it's a wonderful project, especially getting the real stories from people is so important. Now, I have a comment for the last clip where the lady addressed the issue of public health and support. I felt really spoken to because I'm an immigrant in this country. And so my question is, storytelling is great and messages are very important, but now you're sending out this message from a lady who has a very strong opinion about these things, but who might offend somebody who is affected by what she's saying. So now how do you go back and actually facilitate the dialogue between her, I don't want to say shifting the blame from I'm not taking the money, somebody else is, mm-hmm. towards the person that is feeling attacked by what she is saying?
What's fascinating, I really understand the spirit of that question, because one of the things that Question Bridge does automatically is bring all kinds of provocative and controversial issues to the surface. I mean, maybe you caught from the trailer questions about the N-word and how that exists in the Black community. Well, one of the things that Question Bridge does, and this is how we as artists sort of sculpt the message or curate the message, is that we take these powerful questions and then structure it around multiple answers. And so you have one answer from a young woman who has views about the roles of immigrants. You might get another answer from someone who feels totally differently. And that array of contradictory, sometimes, answers represents a bigger, deeper picture of where the humanity of the Black community, in this case, or welfare mothers, for example, really resides. But we don't feel as if it's the mission of Question Bridge as a project to answer all of those questions. It really is about exposing the wisdom and contradictions and the complexity of what it means, in this case, to be a Black man. So we hope that the project itself, by exposing that humanity, stimulates conversations. But in the curriculum that we designed, where, of course, as an educator, what you want is not only to raise meaningful questions with students, but provide them with ways of seeking answers and research. We have lesson plans and bibliographies that stimulate richer conversations so that students get a chance to hear multiple sides around these issues. Does that address your question?
Yeah, I think it's a great question too, because I just wanted to add one layer to that, that artists have a freedom to kind of put out stories in a very open way, in a way that NGOs have to be more careful about more strategic messaging and to really take responsibility for those messages that it's branding with its programs and mission. And in that case, what all of this new media calls on is for NGOs to act more like curators, and whereas not to offer a diversity of opinion, because you can certainly put down some thought leadership, you know, with a very clear message of what you believe about a certain issue, but carefully curating the stories of your audience to speak to a range of points of view, I think puts back on any NGO the ability to hold diverse, a really broad conversation and manage it, and understanding that no subject area, no issue area that you're in is simple. But a model like this, perhaps Question Bridge might be too open for some of the more strategic opportunities that you might have in front of you. But with curation, as Chris was saying, I think you could really architect some very effective messaging that also went two ways.
There's a question in the back.
Yes. Is Question Bridge a technology, or is it a method that you're using a different and gaining a product,
what
a different
great
product to use?
I think of it as being a methodology that in this case is using video as the medium and the web as a medium for conveying the meanings that emerge from the community. But the assumption is that all of the wisdom and insight that a community needs to heal itself is there, but it's simply kept behind the barriers that we put between ourselves and prevent sort of a sharing of information. So Question Bridge is a methodology for getting those questions and answers to come to the surface so they can be shared. And as Wendy said, what we do as artists is curate the flow of those questions and answers so that it adds up to a meaning that hopefully enriches the community and creates opportunities for growth.
Christine, with the LifeBridge Foundation and also with World Listening, and a lot of my work is dedicated towards listening, and what you've described sounds fantastic. And I have a question. In my experience, it seems that actually people being face-to-face, having conversations and listening to each other is sort of ultimately the most transformative way of engaging and listening. What you described as this overcoming the obstacle of bringing certain people into the same room sounds like a wonderful thing. And I'm wondering whether this looks great as we watch it, what the impact of other people, say, in those communities watching these conversations is, as opposed to something else that actually might take a lot of time and work to actually bring people together. I mean, it seems like it could be a gateway from one to the other.
That's exactly what it is. So the best case study of the way Question Bridge influences communities is what happens when it's shown in a community setting. What I've noticed is that what it does is it gives people who inherently identify with either a question or an answer a way to start conversations that begin around Question Bridge. Because it's really important for us as curators of this project to get the widest possible range of voices involved so that it feels as if you could stop, in this case, any black man on the street and simply give them a chance to ask a question and answer it. And so if you put it together properly, when you show this in a black community, any person in the audience gets a chance to either hear their question or their answer embodied. And they start conversation with the person next to them. And so it's been the most amazing catalyst for community-enriching conversations. And that's why we started doing it in public. So last weekend at Wesleyan, we called elders and emerging leaders, young people in the black community up in Middletown, together on the stage. And the conversation that it elicited when young people finally got a chance to ask questions. Like, here's a good example. This may sound like a very simple thing, but think about what it means for a very young boy to ask for the first time an elder, so how do you tie a tie? No one has taught me how to tie a tie. And so a man got a chance to say, well, you could go to a library or go to a website, but that's just an example of what gets started when you bring these questions and answers to the surface in a proper setting that allows then for ongoing conversations.
I think we should, I know there's a lot more questions here. Let's move on. Questions for Question Bridge, which I love. Let's thank Chris for that. I think that was really
great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And next, it's my pleasure to introduce Derek Hell, who I've been working with for quite a number of years, met through Sundance. She's an award-winning filmmaker with an extraordinary film that has already begun to have an equally extraordinary impact in the communities in which she works. And I think one thing that I've really learned from doing this work is the new ways that filmmakers and artists are looking at their subjects and the new kind of relationships that are bubbling up between the people who you turn the camera on and the kind of stories that are elicited and what happens to those stories, that there is just an extraordinary partnership and respect that certainly documentary filmmakers have always had. But in this case, the passion and power that Dara has brought to this work in partnership with the NGOs around the world is really moving. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dara Kell.
Thank you so much, Wendy, and it is such an honor to be with you here today. Thank you so much for inviting us. About 5 years ago, in 2007, my husband, Christopher Nietzsche, and I were doing filmmaking workshops around the United States, teaching young people how to use video, encouraging them to use media in their human rights work on issues like healthcare and housing. And one of our dear friends, who we worked with for many years, sauntered up to us and said, here's an academic article. You might be interested in this because you grew up in South Africa. So I said, yes, this is really interesting. And, you know, Chris and I had been back to South Africa on and off, and I read the article, and it was called Struggle is a School. It was written by Richard Pithouse, an amazing academic and writer from South Africa. And the article was about a new social movement in South Africa called Abahlali Basmjondolo, which is Zulu for people of the shacks. And at that point, it was 2007, the movement was only 2 years old. But already, the ideas that were coming out of the movement were something that I, growing up in South Africa, had been excited by in 1994 when Nelson Mandela became president. And as a teenager, seeing the birth of a new country. But over time, having seen so many betrayals in South Africa and seeing millions and millions of poor people without adequate housing, seeing shack dwellers talking about democracy, bottom-up democracy, talking about living politics, young high school children talking with illiterate grandmothers about how do we work with the government to get what we need. This is what the article was talking about. And the man who gave it to us, Willie Baptist, he said, maybe you might want to make a film about this. And so, you know, talking about curation, Wendy, you know, I think this NGO that we were working with called the Poverty Initiative, it's based here in New York at Union Theological Seminary, they were really, they saw that we shared their same vision, the vision of making media to strengthen a global movement to end poverty. We share the same passion, and that was the beginning of a four-year journey. The film has completely taken over my life and Chris's life, and in a wonderful, wonderful way. And what I really want to speak to today about is about journeys and about being open to new collaborations, not just with feature-length films like this, but with any kind of storytelling. So I'm just going to open with showing you the trailer so you can see a little bit of the film.
South Africa's international isolation is over.
Nelson Mandela begins a new era in South Africa.
We are going to build houses for you. It is not something that we can achieve overnight.
Today was another day of sporadic flare-ups with exchanges of bricks, tear gas, and bullets. Across the country, disgruntled residents demand immediate housing. They say elected officials have done nothing but enrich themselves.
I've never expected that we'll be fighting for something that we've been promised.
We have said we would want to eradicate informal settlements by the year 2014. Municipalities have been given much more power to prevent the emergence of new slums.
I would like to meet Dr. Nelson Mandela and ask him, how does he feel? What he has been jailed for has never been achieved.
They were going to each and everyone's house,
carrying bush knives, carrying guns.
They've demolished a lot of sheikhs, and now they're threatening to demolish mine.
Nobody is thrown out. Everything we've done is within the Constitution.
No one may be evicted from their home without an order of court. This thing is unconstitutional.
Being poor in life doesn't mean that you are even poor in mind.
So that's why we must rise up now and take action. Now.
Viva the spirit of togetherness, viva!
The Shack Dwellers Action Group is challenging provincial authorities in the Constitutional Court.
You don't need to be old to be wise. That is why we think we need to show our character while we are still young.
So I just want to talk about how the film first came about with the Poverty Initiative. And you can see here their mission is they're dedicated to raising up generations of religious and community leaders committed to building a movement to end poverty led by the poor. And so right from the beginning, before we went on our first shoot, we met with the members of the Poverty Initiative. We spoke about what this film could be. And there was, because we'd worked together with them over years, there was already a relationship of mutual respect. They knew that as filmmakers, Chris and I were going to, you know, take some creative liberties. But at the same time, we wanted throughout the filmmaking process, which we didn't know it was going to be 4 years, but we thought it would be quite long, but we wanted to, throughout the filmmaking process, hold on to those core values. And what we really wanted to communicate was, yes, the importance of the Abakhali movement in South Africa, but also the global relevance. Around the world, 1 billion people live in slums. Every year, 2 million people are forcibly evicted from their homes. And so we wanted to make the film in a way that spoke to the situation in South Africa, but also where other people around the world could look at this and be inspired by these young people who are taking their destiny into their own hands and who are uniting with people across class lines, across color lines. So that was really what we got from that first, from those first meetings at the Poverty Initiative. And over the course of 4 years, we would go and film, we would come back to New York, we would screen our footage, we would organize exchanges with the members of Abahlali from South Africa. They would come here. Mazwi, who at the time was 16, he's one of the main characters in the film. He came to the United States and attended a leadership school with that the Poverty Initiative had organized in West Virginia, where they invited young people from across the United States and Brazil as well to talk about what is leadership, how can poor people rise up and become leaders in their communities. And that relationship really deepened. And as you see in the trailer, one of the things that happened while we were filming was that the movement actually got attacked. The local government sent an armed mob, thugs, to attack the people that we were filming with. And we had to all flee for our lives. Their homes were demolished, and the movement went through a really, really difficult time where, you know, there was a clear attack on their movement. At that point, Chris and I stayed up for a few nights in a row, edited a 10-minute video with some of the footage that we had captured over those few days. We put it on YouTube, and the people in the United States who already knew these people and loved them as comrades and as mentors, they swung into action. They organized petitions. They went to the South African embassy here in New York. They got in touch with people in Moscow, in New Zealand. There were protests all around the world. And that sent a very clear message to the South African government that the world is watching. And Sibu Zekode, who is the founding president of the movement, said that those protests saved his life. And so that's the power of really looking for new relationships, and the film is a centerpiece of that. But it goes so much beyond the film, so that was a really powerful experience for us to see that those relationships were real. It's what the movement calls living solidarity. It's not just clicking somewhere. It's actually, you know, getting out of the living room, getting off the computer, and taking real action. And when the film was finished, we then worked again with the Poverty Initiative to organize a month-long screening tour of the United States. We brought again two members of the movement here, and we went to Stanford. We went to church basements, we went to community halls, we went to theaters, again, connecting with the Poverty Initiative's base. And so there was a real, a wonderful reciprocal relationship with us and the Poverty Initiative. And then over time, that expanded. And as we made the film, as we started to make new connections, we started to just meet people who shared the same vision of as we did, and you might know some of these guys, and we have many more organizations that we're working with. And for example, the other day, someone from Australia, a trade union organization in Australia, contacted us asking to host a screening of the film, and their audience members got together and donated $5,000 to the Abahlali movement in South Africa towards their legal expenses, because they're still fighting evictions. And so, you know, just these amazing journeys that we can take when we collaborate. And, you know, in terms of filmmakers who are passionate about these issues, this is one issue, and you are all working on many, many different issues. And there are many people like me who are just aching to work with people like you, who you have the expertise, you have the decades-long experience. And so while we were making the film and working with these partners, we would show them rough cuts. They would help us to write the text cards and make sure that they were legally, factually, academically sound. And then once the film was finished, that was something that they could really stand behind and that they could really get out to their constituents. Like, for example, when we had our theatrical premiere in Brooklyn at the Brooklyn Film Festival, Witness, who we've worked with for years, they tweeted our screenings out to, I think they have 330,000, probably more now, Twitter followers, and our screenings were sold out really quickly. Then Witness made a short video called People Before Profit, and we contributed some of our footage from Dear Mandela to that video. And we also gave them editorial advice on the video in the rough cut stages. So those are just a few examples of the kind of collaborations that we've had. And together we actually came up with the goals for our audience engagement campaign to nurture and inspire new leaders, to educate slum residents about their rights, to build relationships, and to advocate for the protection of human rights defenders. And all of these things are actions that all of the partners have taken in different ways. And so, you know, just working across silos has been really powerful. You know, it's not just about housing. You know, this has been about human rights defenders. It's been about women's rights. And so, one film, you can use it in so many different ways. And I want to tell you a little bit about what we did with the Center for Constitutional Rights in Haiti. In October last year, we took the film for 5 days to Port-au-Prince, and we showed a new Creole version of the film in the displacement camps, where 1 in 5 residents are facing an active threat of eviction. These screenings were incredibly powerful. We saw women, young people, asking questions that CCR had said, you know, this is incredible to see them asking these questions. How do we unite with other camp leaders? You know, at that point, there'd been a really brutal wave of evictions and morale was really low. And so it was CCR's idea to say, let's take this film, let's hire Haitian actors, let's re-record it so that it's a totally new Creole version. And let's go and take it to people who never, there are so few films that are translated into Creole. So even just that act was powerful in and of itself. And we're actually expanding the program based on this model. It was so successful, and we're now looking for more films to translate into Creole and working again with the same filmmaker, Zach Niles, in Haiti, to make these more of these films available. And I just want to read to you what one of the camp leaders said after the screening. He said, learning about how Abakhlali advances the struggle for housing has shown us here in Haiti how we can strengthen our movement. And so we gave a lot of DVDs out, they distributed those, and they continue to watch them today. That's just one of the amazing ways that you can use these films and take them on a journey. You know, we had no idea that we would now be organizing leaders from Haiti to go and visit with the South African shack dwellers along with their lawyers. And so for us, it's been this marriage of, you know, the hitting the streets, the community mobilizing together with the law. And so we've had amazing partnerships with lawyers as well, like at the CCR. And I just want to talk about how powerful it has been to see from our first video we put up in 2007, we had 15,000 views. Because of working with these NGOs, we now have 151,000 views just of our trailer in 150 countries. The film has now screened in 35 countries. It's been translated into 6 languages and counting. All of this is crowdsourced. We have not, up until this point, had any outreach funding. It's been small line items that these NGOs have been able to write in. A lot of it has been just passionate people coming on board. We make a template of our transcript available for people to access, and people come to us and say, I really want to show this in Italy. Please, can I translate this for you? And then we do the subtitles. So, you know, I mean, everything is difficult. There's never enough money. There's never enough time. But what you do have is people like me, people who are just bursting with energy and who want to work with you. And what's exciting to me as a filmmaker, I think this is such an exciting time to be a filmmaker, because never before have we been able to track our impact and track how people are responding to our media. This is we have all these new tools, and we can really drill down into what specific things are affecting. Like when we had our New York Times review, we saw that our trailer views jumped right up And that's just from the stats on Vimeo. And then the challenge for us was, how do we keep that momentum going? And so our partner, Amnesty International, wrote a blog about our United States tour, making parallels with Mandela and with Obama. And they sent that out to their 3 million supporters in 150 countries. And you can see there that the, you know, we were able to really keep that momentum going there for a while. And what we're also using is Sparkwise, as Wendy mentioned. And that is incredible to get not only the quantitative data of how many people are tweeting after screenings, but also that qualitative data. So I can look here at my dashboard and see how many Twitter followers I have, but also what people are saying. And that's really important to us, because we wanted the film to be inspiring. So we want to make sure that people are walking out of the theater or watching it on TV and saying, wow, I want to be just like Masri. And we see that people are live tweeting during the film and during the first broadcast in South Africa. So many people in South Africa were live tweeting that hashtag Dear Mandela became the number two trending topic in South Africa. And we were kind of refreshing and just completely thrilled to see that people were in their living rooms and talking to each other. People were having conversations about story points and correcting each other. And that was just amazing to watch, you know, from our, you know, we were both at work and kind of, you know, taking time off and checking our Twitter feeds. What we've also been using is Storify. And Storify is just a way for us to tell the story of one particular campaign. So when we do these screening tours and when we do things like a United Kingdom premiere, then we can see how it's playing, what people are saying, our favorite tweets, some of the reviews, some of the photos. So we use those tools, and we really like to see what people are saying. And I just wanted to show you. I just wanted to show you this last piece. The film has really taken on a life of its own. And this is something that was organized without us in South Africa. And they're giving away signed copies of the Constitution. And so, you know, it's just incredible once you put the film out there. I emailed Stuart, the lawyer, and I said, did you organize this? He said, no, not me. So this is a good sign. So it's an exciting time. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Are there questions off the bat for Dara? Because let me do, please, yeah.
Hi, can you hear me? Yes, I have both a comment and a question. The first comment is, I hope that you and your colleague next to you are talking about doing something together, because it seems to me you have a natural question bridge project. And my question is, I understand the film has not yet been released. Is that correct?
It has been released, yeah.
I'm wondering whether the natural question that was presented in the film has been answered yet by Mandela. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your question. Mandela has not, to our knowledge, seen the film. We really respect his wishes to be able to have his retirement in peace. But we do know that his nephew has seen the film. He wrote us a really long letter about how moved he was by the film, and he wants to use it. And so he wants to show it to school kids, and he was just, you know, really, really moved by it and I think humbled. And so, yeah, I mean, we hope to engage more of the Mandela family.
By way of doing just a brief wrap-up before we open it up, and those of you who have not spoken, we really would love to hear from you, and I'll have a couple of questions for you, if you would indulge me. But there's something that you may not know, that most of the time, Chris and Dara and I and Eric are in environments where we are talking to a room full of media makers, filmmakers and storytellers, really giving them advice and strategy of how to work effectively with you all. Like, we do that regularly, because filmmakers are in a bad habit of, certainly not these guys, but some more of the old school filmmakers, of making their film sequestered off by themselves and then finishing their work of art and then knocking on the door of an NGO saying, here, help me, distribute this, use this in your movement. And mostly the NGOs will look back and say, who are you? We're busy, and we're doing things, and we don't know you. And the door gets closed, and there's no partnership to create the kind of environment that these guys have managed to create. And so here we are, here, talking to you guys about, wow, how can not only you work more effectively with filmmakers and media makers and have the impact in social media that you want to have, but how do you become, how can we facilitate better storytelling from within your organization as well? Because you don't have to look outside for others to tell your story, but it's within these partnerships early on in the process. One word of warning is that when you do work with a filmmaker like these guys, the idea is that there's a couple of different ways of going about it. You can hire a filmmaker to do a work for you that is really directed by your organization. That's different from the kind from Question Bridge or from Dear Mandela, where you're in partnership with an artist that ultimately has a complex story to tell. But even if the film doesn't hit every single point that you feel completely good about bringing into your organization, working together early on will help you find those pieces of that film that can really serve you and help your organization. So all this is to say, to be open to those partnerships, to work collaboratively, the kind of ways that they suggested about partnering. I'm really curious to hear from you all, are you bringing storytelling into your work at this point? And really, I go back to the title of the briefing and the question that Gail posed here, how do NGOs leverage social media to reach broad audiences? I might also suggest, how do we use social media platforms to truly engage our audience? And engage is a bit of a buzzword these days, and it means something different to everyone. I'm really curious, and I know that we all are, of what engagement looks like for you on the ground. How do you know when your audience and constituents are really engaged in a movement, when you are being effective? What does that look like for you? Because then if we can hear a little bit about that, we can also then talk more specifically about how to leverage the extraordinary power of social media to be able to deepen that. But we don't want to say, go get 100,000 followers on Twitter if your people don't tweet. You know, some people really do. And the idea that you could frame your messages to reach broader audiences and also get them doing things and moving in the world is also really important to us. So if there's any brave souls out there who could give us some stories from the field, we'd really love it. Yeah.
Hello. I'm not a brave, well, maybe I am a brave soul. I'd like to ask, because this documentaries are very exciting, and I'm not one of the people who poo-poos television, so I watch the good stuff on television, and I see more and more. And and I saw yesterday young people were being taught how to make videos on the Manhattan Neighborhood Network. They had something that was thrilling. So I'm very excited. The question is how to get the solutions, how to get the answers, not just how to get questions, because I've been coming to the UN since I retired, and we have experts always giving us questions, but they never tell us what they know to be and what they would like to be as the answers. And I see that there are new answers, because there's new technology and new problems, but there is an old way of seeing things that is often poo-pooed. And it's called, if something is progressive, excuse me, or liberal, and those words have changed over the years, it gets poo-pooed as dangerous to statehood. Now, I feel that's a very important issue, and I'm not sure how I'm going to frame it to this, but there is a way of answering, getting answers that is implied in the work. Like when the woman said, gave that, there are immigrants, you know, they're people who get the money, and you can see how that person is a victim of the media and how mainstream media needs to be pursued and overcome is something that has to be addressed by us. But I saw, you know, a cross-cutting of something else might have, you know, the danger is show the controversy. But that woman is a victim. That answer shows that she's victimized. And I think in the manufacture of that documentary, there is life is full of missed opportunities. But there is a cross-cutting that could have solved that problem. Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm really glad I showed that clip.
Yeah.
Because I can see it really exemplified not only the problem, the problem of, as you said, the people who most need these answers often don't have a way to articulate them. But a lot of this project begins with a real act of faith. And the act of faith is that not only are the questions that drive, in this case, the black male community, okay, not only are those questions implicit in the community itself, but those answers in all their forms are implicit. But there isn't an assumption on my part or the part of the people on the team that there's any single answer that we have to it. Our faith is that if you give people a chance to really freely address their own individual responses to that question, that the community hearing itself will have a better opportunity to move collectively toward what is the best answer for that group. And so, for example, when you ask a really provocative question, like, for example, how should the black male community relate to the use of the N-word? That's a very intense, powerful question that's inherent in the black male community, with many different answers to that arrayed across media and individuals. But I think if the community itself gets to hear the collective answers that many individual men have to that question, then as a group, they can know themselves better, just like we're all trying to do as individuals, and move toward what is an accommodating answer. And so none of us really feel didactically that we can impose answers. Our hope as artists is that we can bring those answers and questions to the surface.
And I'd like to, let me just piggyback just a little bit, since in my work, I act as a facilitator and translator between artists and NGOs, who are like, we don't want to offer answers. And to the NGOs who are like, we need to give our people some answers. And we need next steps, and we need to be practical. And there are ways that if you let the story speak its truth and be its authentic storytelling self, and then you bring in your voice, it doesn't have to happen exactly in parallel, but stemming from, can you hit play on there, darling? That there are tactics and ways that you can take a complex story that may not offer answers and put a stake in the ground and say, for us, this is what we're going to do. And these are the steps that we feel are the right ones that are part of a solution. Because solutions-based storytelling is one type of storytelling. And there's no reason to say we have to, you know, to leave something in complication, I think, is sometimes very important. But also we are looking for answers, as you said. So there are toolkits. There are some, I put up some steps that I use when I work with partner organizations of just things to keep in mind when you are looking for some solutions-based storytelling, but to keep in mind there are often many, many answers, but no one knows your constituents like you and what they need and what may be the way to go from the story into direct action that does need some solutions-based storytelling. Is it okay to move on? Yeah? Okay, great. Do you want to choose people?
Let me start with June in the front.
Okay.
I was going to say something before, though.
Okay.
Perhaps I should say what I want to say before Joan asks a question. Okay, in 2 seconds. No, you're not on, Joan. Not on yet. No, I was just saying that I wanted to say something before you ask your question in terms of where we are. I think we are at the point of, we've just sort of transitioned into social media. We understand traditional media well, I think, because most NGOs tend to have at least a newsletter. Our challenge right now is how to tell the stories, even how to respond to what we have. For instance, you talked about, you know, we have 1,000 tweets. But we've put in most of the work on that. What we're trying to get now is for people to respond back to the messages. We had a blog which was really active, but it didn't elicit a whole lot of people talking back. And we, in order for us to have more interactivity and for your voices to be heard, then you need to be there. You need to respond back to what is said. If you look at the latest blog, for example, it's written by a young man who is a youth rep and who is autistic, and who about 3 weeks ago wrote a really interesting piece, and I hope that you will look at it on Tumblr, on our Tumblr, on, you know, what it means, how difficult it is for someone like him to deal with trying to be a youth rep, wanting to be very social on one hand, but having to deal with you know, the question of touch and the extrasensory of lights and sound, and what it, the response on his body, and how much he's had to struggle with that. And I thought that was a really powerful piece that I would expect to resonate in different ways within an NGO community.
It's hard to get the feedback, you know.
But it's getting the feedback.
Right.
Joan.
Well,
okay. Hello. Thank you. It was just wonderful.
Now you're on. When the red is on, you're on.
When the red, could you believe that I've spent my life in communication? No. Anyway, I represent the UN, I represent an NGO called ECPAT, End Child Prostitution and Trafficking. When I first came to the UN, it was a no-no. No, this didn't happen here. It happened in Southeast Asia. It happened in Africa. It happened all over the world, but not the United States. Now, I told you when I introduced myself before that I was here to learn something, that I am a great storyteller. I would love to tell stories, but I really did not know about this technique. It absolutely lends itself to what we do at ECPAT. It's, you know, telling a story, getting the publicity, wanting to know what happens. I think that the young interns at our main office probably know a lot about the feedback, because I know that in the several years since I've represented ECPAT, our fame, so to speak, notoriety has grown tremendously. Our board of directors has grown. Our association with the rest of the world, because there is an ECPAT International. And I intend to take what I'm learning today to bring back, to find out. They may be doing this. I don't know. I'm in a public relations part of this at the UN.
You know, people like, there are so many folks exactly like you trying to figure this thing out.
Exactly.
And in trafficking, you know, there's a whole Women and Girls Initiative that's going on right now, Half the Sky. But there's a child trafficking game that has been developed that people are like, oh, we can't get anyone to respond to the blog. And then they did a game, and they have tens of thousands of people playing this game, raising awareness. I mean, my big question is, what happens once the awareness is raised?
Well,
where's the change?
Yes.
And so as long as that's where it comes to the organizations like yours to make those, make those connections.
Yes, we just have a movie out that won a prize of some kind in Los Angeles, and we're getting so big that we're concentrating on different parts, and that closeness that we used to have as a little group is leaving. So thank you again.
Hi, Judy Lerner. Is it on?
Yes.
Judy Lerner, Peace Action. This has been so interesting for me. But I feel that in the conversations that we've been, and the questions we've asked, one thing for me has not been addressed, and that is the issue of listening. I went to Israel and Palestine about 8 years ago with a special group, and we couldn't go and meet with both sides unless we were trained in compassionate listening. And it was a very difficult situation when you get people who are so opposed to one another. And we're dealing with that here in terms of reconciliation. How does this all move into that? How do we get people to listen to the other person? You've raised the question. Thank you.
Well, of course, this is right up my alley. Because in that little thought experiment that I did with the making you invisible, I mean, that was intended to highlight what settings might make it possible for people to really listen one to the other. And how, as an artist, could we create something that's strategically designed to facilitate listening? So I described in that first little project that I did with kids, it was actually a very big project with kids in cars. We had a badge around their necks that said to the audience, shut up and listen to me. And that worked. The reason why it worked is because the middle-class white people who were the audience for that project really wanted to know what goes on in the minds of young black and brown kids. They really wanted to know. But they were afraid to go up and say, talk to me. And so the project created a setting where it became possible for them to at least eavesdrop on these kids who were talking as if they were by themselves. But my feeling in creating Question Bridge was that was not enough. Because listening is a kind of passive way to be very generous, just like you're all listening to me now. But if what I'm saying provokes in you, or if coming to the presence of this project, you have questions, a question sets up the questioner to listen to the answer. Do you see what I'm saying? And so that's why I based this second project on questions, because I really believe that we are our questions, frankly. Our questions define us. And so if we can simply find a way to bring those questions to the surface, then people who want to engage with you will provide you with answers. Now, as I said earlier, you may get many more answers than you can. You may get many more answers than you expect. So what you do with those answers is a whole other question. But at least the process of asking a question and getting an answer is started. And that's, I think, as artists, all we can do.
Thank you so much. Oh, tons of questions. I'm going to take the one on the left. Yes.
Thank you. The question that I'm anxious to ask, how does one really, as NGO, use social media to tell their own stories instead of others telling our stories? And what I would like to see you do, because I'm at the ground level at the present, if you go out in on the website or on your iPod or your superhighway instrument that usually all of us have, and there is a case, all you have to do is say, Nun sues Walt Disney for $1 billion against Sister Act. That comes out of my life. That's my life story. Now, it has stopped me from continuing to tell my story. How do I use social media if the NGO do not have the way with it all, the legal means to reclaim or to fight their stories? How do we do that through social media? You'll see what's out there once you go out to the media. And it's very rich. It's overwhelming. And all we did is file the case even without suing the person or the persons, but we filed, and social media jumped up, but we didn't know how to use social media to move forward. How do we do that?
You know, that is such a good question. And it's hard to come up to speed. It's like just jumping on Twitter and tweeting willy-nilly is going to work at cross purposes from what you really need to do. To really do social media right, there has to be someone at the staff level who's responsible for the external messaging of that organization so that there is a unified voice, even if it's a part-time person. That, I don't know what's wrong with that slide. Even if it's a part-time person who really, for the bottom line, that the voice of the organization is consistent and has clarity. Doesn't mean that staff members cannot tweet or make Facebook posts or blog posts individually, but at least they know who the official voice of the organization is. At that point, you develop a strategy and a story. And you can, I can't go into deeply into the individual how-to methodology of each platform, because there is, if you have the wherewithal, there are people who work as social media strategists who can sit with staff people and say, look, here's your goal. Here's how many people you want to reach. Here's the story that you need to tell. You can break up tweets over the course of a week or two. You can schedule them that they will go out. You need to have someone, if somebody is responding to your tweets, you need to have someone on staff to respond back so that you're in some way controlling your own story. Because if you're controlling your own story, then you know the world is going to explode, but you can do crisis management around that story and you know when you need to respond. But you have to consider the many platforms that are out there and where your people are and where you want to be. Certainly, you know, the major ones right now, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Pinterest, Reddit, anywhere, is that pretty, yeah. Instagram, right, Instagram is also big. And you realize, do you want to have a strategy there? Do you want to have a presence? And what that is. The two real main guide words that have been guiding NGOs in this space, authenticity and transparency. So don't try to sell a bill of goods to the public. They want to know the real deal. And you have to be willing to put a stake in the ground and let your public know the truth about your organization, where you stand on the issues, and what you want them to do. And then if you have the container to hold it, the story can then spread out. But that's what people respond to. People won't retweet a canned piece of vocabulary. They will retweet a personal story from one of your constituents. They will retweet a piece of insight that they don't know and a link to a website that they haven't seen. So it really is, it means stepping back before you go forward to really create a consistent and powerful story on a number of different platforms and then hire someone, throw a little money at the problem so that you can start to really grow your voice in a sophisticated way. But sounds like you're really on the right track just asking those questions.
Thank you so much, Wendy. Let me take somebody else and I'll come back to you. Lady in the, yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, first of all. My name is Stacey Hanrahan, and I'm an NGO with the Congregation of Notre Dame, which is a Catholic group of sisters, the type that's kind of the nuns on the bus type, if that's helpful to some. I'm just very grateful for this presentations this morning. And I'm going back, my remarks are occasioned by, I think, a question asked initially about how do you know when people are engaged? Mm-hmm. And for me, that's always been around if there's life and if there's energy in the room. You know, something's going on or there's something coming back. I do a lot of presentations. And you know when it's dead or you're dying, and you know when people are engaged. What I found so moving, really, and helpful in the presentations was around the idea of creating, I think, Chris, you used the term, safe space, mm-hmm. where dialogue can arise, but there's a lot of, and I so agree with the pre-work that needs to happen to create that kind of space. So I thank you for that, and also the power of mixing story and data. And it's so important because the story is what captures people's imagination. And the data then has a context or has a passion to it. So that's most helpful. The other piece I just want to say is really it seems to me that we're at a time that the shift we need to see is not so much answers as deeper questions, wider questions. And what I heard you tapping into was was that idea of how do we really have true conversation where we can go deeper in the questions and our solutions then become wider. It seems to me there's a temptation, or I see it that way sometimes. People do want to take action quickly, and that's important. However, if it's only at the level of, or when it's at primarily the level of fixing a particular problem and not in a wide enough context to keep going with what's the real problem?
That's what's powerful to me. Thank you for that. I think that's really incredible. And Eric, I'm going to put you on the spot here for a second because we do have Google in the house, and that doesn't happen too often. And Eric spends so much of his day collecting data to get people to do things and to gain insight. Could you come grab the mic for a second, Eric, and let folks get a little insight into how they might approach the data that they have in order to really action their communities?
I think when it comes to story, it's the ability to change someone's heart or open the mind, and that's extremely powerful. And then I work in a company that's extremely data-driven. It's looking at numbers to show you things and to reveal things you otherwise would not have seen, to let you know like what's hot and emerging and trending. And I think the true power, and we've seen a great example of this here, is when you really do, as you were talking about, marry the two together. That if you're going into a community in India and providing vaccinations, you have the map of exactly where you're going. You have a dot for every location. The dot increases as you invest in that location. Next to that, you have the real-time counter of the actual number of vaccinations that you've distributed. And then that gives you kind of the anchor. And then on top of that anchor is when you insert the video. And the video then, actually, you can take someone in the community and they can describe exactly how much you've changed their community. And when you put the video next to the hard numbers and you have the impact stories next to the impact numbers, that's when you're really showing your kind of contribution of what you're putting back out there into the world.
So much. Oh, you want to add? Go. Yeah, and then we'll get there and there.
Yeah, just because your point about the importance of thinking strategically about safety, I want to give a couple of case studies from QuestionBridge, just an example. Well, one of them was we only do question bridges within a demographic, not between them. Not because we don't think that, for example, racism doesn't exist between groups, because we all know that it does. But when you provide opportunities for people within a demographic to ask and answer questions, you see traces of this very human instinct to discriminate. But all the faces are black. And I think that you get insight into racism, for example, in this example, that you wouldn't get if you see it with the familiar faces. And so sometimes you have to take what seem like counterintuitive approaches based on a sort of understanding of human nature, of what will and won't allow for people to really express the questions that are at the source of their lives. Like, for example, we realized that we couldn't have any women in the room when these men were asking their questions, because it just changes what comes to their mind.
Typical excuse. Yeah.
At the back. The gentleman way at the back.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. My name is Choma. I'm with Friendship Ambassadors Foundation. It's really a wonderful presentation you all made this morning. My question, or more or less like a brainstorm, is how, because my organization is involved in youth empowerment and program from different parts of the world. We have one coming up this August, where we have a youth from various parts of the world come down here at United Nations to undergo a two-day empowerment program. And on the other hand, we're also involved in a cultural exchange, whereby we integrate different cultural diversity and how it could make a positive impact in our society. Now, my question, or more or less a brainstorm, is how can we, you know, with the communication department, you know, make this program become much more reachable to people around the world in order to, for them to learn the various programs on empowerment that normally take place between these days, so that when they return to their communities, they will be able to utilize whatever tool they have learned to create or make impact in their society or in their various community, no matter how small it is. So how can this our organization and with the communication department section will be able to integrate and also with other NGOs who are also involved with youth programs, because integrating intact collectively will be able to make a broader and a wider impact in the world at large, because various NGOs have different visions in a way that it also impacts youth empowerment. So how can we all integrate together to make this achievable? Because the question right now is, how do we now make this impact, and how do we work with the communication and possible other tools or media and social networks? Thank you.
Thank you. Wendy, I think we should take the last question at the same time.
Okay.
Yeah, Jerry Spivak, CCCUN. The question you raised was how NGOs might see this and working with this. And I think we all can take away a lot of possible, you know, ways this can be used, but I want to raise the problem with storytelling. We have just seen yesterday the results of storytelling versus money and power. When the gun legislation was stopped by a concerted campaign by the gun industry to make sure that nothing was passed. So storytelling is something that may let people hear something, but not act upon that hearing. And it seems to me that until we connect storytelling with a very clear collection of routines that will give goals, that will give organizations the opportunity to use something that will move through various processes to reach those goals, we don't have a connected thing. All people know how to do right now is say like whenever they see Facebook, and that doesn't get you anywhere other than letting your friends know that you happen to have something in common. You can't even dislike something easily, because that's against the monetary direction of Facebook. So there is that major difficulty, and then we have the further difficulty, which is as soon as you build it, the richest companies will be the ones who use it more than the NGOs, because they have vast amounts of money to continue inequality, to continue wars, and to continue the various things that some of our organizations are meant to counteract. And I don't know what the answer is to, again, storytelling versus money and power.
I love this group. I love this group. You know, it's like, I love the internet because it is, in the best case scenario, about the democratization of media. And new tools that come up that can be used by the bad people really are meant for the good people. And, I mean, the answer to your question is keep doing the work. There is no stepping back from this because it sometimes goes bad. I mean, sometimes we think that for those people who are Democrats, they say the Republicans were in power for so long because they told a better story, that Democrats didn't know how to spin the story correctly to get people. Who knows? For whatever reason, the power of storytelling is now in the hands of the people. Nobody negates that. We're not in this country, at least, you know, we're not a part of a country where they can shut down the internet at any time, or they don't, thankfully, don't do it. So the answer there is keep doing it and do it better and include more people. The only reason why it's good to have a lot of likes on Facebook is it's more people that you can activate. When I like having a lot of, you know, I try to build my following. It's more people that you can touch that will then go into the world with an important story. Back to the question in the back about how, because that's, I think, the big question here. I hate coming to briefings like this and conferences where you give out all these great ideas and then you're left with, well, how do I do this? There are a lot of toolkits out there for NGOs in this space. And I'm happy to share some of those with Gail, and she can share them with you. But things like the Human-Centered Design Toolkit, that's for NGOs, is a fantastic way to think about how to bring solutions-based storytelling into your organization. It's wonderful. There's a group in the U.S. called N10, N-T-E-N, an amazing group of like-minded NGOs who are activating around emerging technologies and social media. Some of the best tools and conversations happen at the N10 convening. So if your organization is at that point where, like, we know we need to be here, we have a good story, let's do this. There's even Sundance. The Sundance Institute has recently partnered with the Skoll Foundation for a program called Stories of Change, where I get to work with NGOs all over the world who are trying to bring storytelling into their DNA as a kind of high-level strategist. I would be thrilled to work with any of you to help actualize. Hire Dara and Chris to come to your organization for a week-long workshop, a residency. Bring the expertise inside so you can spread the story. But there are lots of online resources to do this. The steps are not too difficult, but it does take a bit of capacity building within your communications department to say, we are committed to this. And frankly, if you want to have a lot of folks on your blog, make it part of someone's job description in every department, that once a week you write a blog. It doesn't have to be a long one, but going towards that, the notions of transparency and authenticity, you have to be your own storytellers. And you get there with that kind of messaging. And you bring it into, and if you want other people to respond to you, do you know if you work with school classrooms, the best way that I found that filmmakers use to get kids to create stories, to populate new websites, is you take the grant that you get from the MacArthur Foundation, and you give mini grants to classrooms, even at $100 or $200. If you give that money to a teacher and say, this money is to invest in storytelling for your kids, and that I'll come and do a workshop and then they're going to give in stories, it's amazing how a small investment can really go deep and start a full two-way conversation where listening is also involved. To me, that question on listening was so important because storytelling, I feel listening is inherent. That there is, you speak, and in the give back, if we are only waiting for the next turn to talk, we don't really have any movement. But there is that, and you can build that into your platforms, into your new technologies, into your blogs, that space of listening. And you know how you do it? At the end of your blog, you ask a question. The best blogs to me end with a question, because it's an open invitation to your audience to think and respond. But you all, I'm going to speak on behalf of all of us. This has been an extraordinary experience for us. We're looking forward to working together more in the future. So please come and let's have more of the two-way.
Thank you so much, Wendy. And it's interesting how we get spin-off effects because I'm going to soon ask Chuck, who is the chair of the NGO DPI Executive Committee, to introduce another video, which is of tremendous importance to the NGO community because it talks about post-2015. And that came to us because of this workshop. So the spin-off's already happening.
Great.
Just wanted to make that point. Chuck, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Gail, and I want to thank you, Gail, and Catherine and her communications subcommittee for having Wendy and Chris and Dara here today. It's been a wonderful experience for us. We didn't have a chance to talk about this introduction, but I think you're talking about Katie, who is here. Katie, are you here? All right. There is indeed a member of our executive committee is Elizabeth Schumann, and she is involved with bringing the post 2015 MGGs into focus for the following how many years, 10, 15 years. And there's a group in Washington that is associated with that. I thought they were going to be here today, and maybe they were and had to leave early. But we'll make sure we capture them again. Hero, are you here today? Let me make the announcement for HERO then, and that is that next Thursday is the last day to submit nominations for chair of the executive committee and secretary of the executive committee. I will be stepping down, so that position will be open. So we want people to seriously consider running for those two positions or to run for 6 seats on the executive committee. So please, I've left material in the back there for you to pick up and to respond to us in terms of the nominating process. And then finally, I managed to leave my glasses on the bus this morning when I came in, so Catherine has an announcement that I can't read.
Thank you. We have been asked to
come forward a little.
Excuse me. We have been asked by the. I guess I apologize for pronouncing this. By the Ataturk Society, which is giving a 2-day seminar at Stevens Institute of Technology, which is right across the river in Hoboken, called the Light Millennium, and the College of Arts and Letters at the Stevens Institute of Technology jointly would like to invite you to a 2-day international conference on a high-level inaugural panel dedicated to the MDG number 8, which is Global Partnership and International Peace. I have their flyers, so please take a look if you like. But I would like to also take an opportunity for myself to thank Gail for working so hard to put this group together today. You cannot know how hard it was. But I also want to thank Wendy, Chris, and Dayla for the marvelous presentation, because I think you've made our NGOs aware of yet another way that we can tell our story and get our message across. And I promise you that you'll be hearing from all of us. But I also want to acknowledge something else that's very close to me. We've all watched Gail at briefings for I don't know how many years now, and I'm sad to say that she will be leaving the UN at the end of May.
No.
And I think maybe there will be one or more briefings, but certainly in terms of the communications workshop, you've helped us raise it to a higher level, and I think everyone in this room will join me in wishing you well.
Thank you very much, and I'd just like to say thank you so much. It's been a wonderful experience to work with you for the past 4 years. Didn't seem that way, that it's that much time, but it'll be almost 5 years, actually, by the time I leave. I think what you've given me is the ability to take a vision and move it forward, and not by myself, but with you as a group, because we've not done that alone. We've done that as a group. And I think in this particular setting, it's been a group that has worked really tremendously together. And I thank you for all that you've taught me and brought into my life, including Wendy, whom I met accidentally in a Tribeca film festival. And Wendy has become very much part of our network. So it goes to show how life is. And I hope that you will move it forward even further than I have in the future. And I wish you all the really best. I hope one day I'll be able to come back and look at another communications workshop and enjoy it from the other side. I'd like to thank each of you on behalf of the DPI NGO community for being with us. I would thank Wendy from the bottom of my heart for making the effort to come here with her collaborators. And I thank both of you, both Chris and Dara, for being with us. And for it's been a really exciting morning. But where's more? So I hope that those of you who have signed up will be with us this afternoon. It's in the downstairs in GA 1B50, which is the guide's room. It's just off of where the UN bookstore is. Not exactly where the bookstore is. You turn the corner and it's just as you turn the corner within that space. But there will be signs so that you know that you're going the right way, and it's close to where our other colleagues are in the resource center, and they'll be there to show you. So please come this afternoon at 2:15 to 4:30. And be with us and learn some more.
Yeah, you can all build Sparkwise dashboards. It's going to be very cool. And Eric is one of the best workshop facilitators I've ever worked with. You want to work one-on-one with a Google guy, get your data and your maps and your everything all together, he's the guy. So come hang out with us.
I want to say that Catherine wants to say something, but don't forget, as we're still in the room, our next briefing will be on the 2nd of May, and that's a major briefing because we're waiting now to know whether this is our annual World Press Freedom Day briefing. It's usually a big briefing because we normally have the Secretary General there in the morning. We're waiting to hear whether he will be there, but, you know, he has traditionally been there to open that morning. And it's a tribute to journalists and to journalism and to journalists working in really dangerous situations. So we hope that you will come and pay tribute to the people who bring the news to you, sometimes at great cost to themselves. The event will be from 10 a.m., so don't forget that, because the Secretary General enters the room at 10 and we start on the dot. So you need to be there by 10:15 so that you're able to be seated because of the security. It's in Conference Room 2 in this building, the North Lawn Building, and we ask you, as usual, to check the calendar just in case there are any changes. Because, you know, the reason we have changes is because, you know, sometimes with rooms, especially with conference rooms here, if a member state needs the room, we are usually bumped to the bottom of the list. So hopefully that won't happen, and we will be in Conference Room 2, and we look forward to seeing you there. Catherine, you had something else?
I just wanted to remind everyone that the space we have for this afternoon is limited. I think the capacity of the room is 45, so I do hope you've registered, but come anyway, and it'll be first come, first serve if you haven't. But remember, it's a small space.
And bring your laptops, because that's important. Or your tablet.
Thank you. That's right.
Or your mobile phone. Right. Thanks again. Have a great day.